Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan, Blake Murphy, J.D. Bunkus, Justin Cuthbert. Follow J.D. at J.D. Bunkus. Send him your texts, 590-590, or in his Twitter, Instagram DMs, at J.C. Cuthbert on Twitter. I'm Blake Murphy, O.D.C. It's a good morning. Not only did J.D. mention before we hit break that the Wake and Rake won, as did the Homer's Parlay. Toronto Maple Leafs and Toronto Raptors, both successful last night. The Raptors with a no-doubter, you could turn this game off halfway through the third quarter. We didn't, of course. But 133-97 against the corpse of a Brooklyn Nets team without KD and Kyrie and Ben Simmons. And yes, JD, without Joe Harris. And no Steve Nash. Last-minute scratch head coach Steve Nash, who at this point would probably also be their best player on the court. The Toronto Raptors played without OG, without Fred VanVleet. Didn't matter. 133-97. Pretty big win. And I would say that the thing to take from this one, other than, hey, you were just due for a night like this after you got blown out in three of your last four. You got to feast on a banged up opponent like this. This is, you could go back and you could argue between it with some of the first games of the season, but I think this was the first game where unquestionably Scottie Barnes is your best player in a win. 28 points, 16 rebounds, 4 assists, 5 steals, 12 of 14 shooting, hits 10 of 10 in the first half, an excellent defensive game on top of everything else, a number of great transition passes that don't show up assists in the box score. We talked, JD, a lot about what were we looking forward to most and what was most important to us in the second half. Things didn't start as well as we'd like over those first two games, but in two of these first three games now, Scottie Barnes has done what we were asking, which is take all the nice things you've shown and contribute to winning. And he was their best player in the first game out, and then he was by far their most impactful player last night. What'd you see from yet another career night from Scottie Barnes?
So I think there's a couple of interesting things off of this. One is that I wanted to ask you yesterday, but it does seem like when Scotty has a really good night, Siakam doesn't. Or that the other guys around him don't end up having spectacular nights. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is just my thought. I remember the Portland game from earlier in the year that Scotty played really well in, and it didn't seem like the other pieces were going. But this felt in a similar vein in terms of there was just, it was a weirdly who cares because they blew them out. But Siakam had another really poor shooting night from the field. But again, a game where he's not really engaged. And I think Siakam looks at that Brooklyn game and goes, I don't really need to show up here because, A, we're getting a blowout victory, but also this is a try-hard game, and Scotty is a try-hard. I don't really read into much with Barnes last night. I know that he hustles, and I know he works hard, and so that shows up when the other team's leading scorer is LaMarcus Aldridge, who was supposed to be retired last year. Or Blake Griffin, one of the good Blakes, the less of the Blakes, who's in there, and I'm thinking, you know, we were a year removed from this guy never dunking and thinking that he was completely washed up to the point of out of the league. So Scotty got 7 offensive rebounds in the first half. Do I commend him for his effort? Absolutely. Do I think that effort is a skill? Yes. But I also don't really look at Scotty's night and go, wow, he did something spectacular. He really showed off his scoring bag. It's like he put back scores. He scored at the rim. He had 1-3. I think it was his first shot of the game that he nailed. And the rest of it was basically just like hustle plays and getting the ball with deep position against non-rim protectors. So, like, I hope that doesn't come off as negative, but I don't think that there was anything like revelatory to me last night in terms of Barnes's play or the direction of the team. I think you could infer that if you just looked at the box score, but if you watched his play, the game script, the situation, how he was scoring, to me it was kind of like, that's a good game, but that's what I want to see from a rookie with that kind of profile, because that's the exact game that you're supposed to have that in.
I do think there was a confidence element that kind of flowed from the strong start, where he was starting to make some passes that maybe he had lost his confidence in, or just wasn't, like, I don't know. He had some truly tremendous passes in the second half that maybe if tonight's not going as well, he doesn't take those. And then, like you said, effort's a skill too, right? So the Siakam thing, Scotty's 6 highest scoring nights this year. One of them was a bad Pascal game. One of them, Pascal was out, and the other 4, Pascal had 20 plus. So I don't think there's, really. I mean, I don't have it handy,
I thought Fred, that you had all the box scores in front of you.
No, not all of them at once. So, yeah, I mean, look, there's definitely an element of the there are only so many balls to go around, right? And Gary Trent Jr. had another bad night last night, too, and there's no OG. So I think there's maybe two things at play there beyond Scotty just having a great night and taking advantage of an older, slower team. And one is that I've thought throughout the year that Scotty Barnes' field goal attempts were a nice indicator of just how the offense was flowing in general, because to Nick Nurse's own admission last night, they didn't run a play for him. The ball just finds him when things are going well offensively. And you can look at, like, the Raptors had a comical three-point shooting night last night, too, yeah, where no Fred, no OG, and then Gary Trent shoots poorly, and you still shoot 18 of 38 as a team, and you've got Thad Young and Precious Achiuwa knocking them down, no question, off the bench. But I do think there's an element of, and I thought this with OG in his first couple years in the season, too, as he ramped up, is his field goal indicators his field goal attempts are a good indicator of what the offensive environment is like that night. Is stuff coming easy? Are you getting the garbage stuff? Are you getting the improvisational stuff? And then, yeah, the other part of it is probably just that when things are going well for everyone else, there aren't enough balls around it. And where Scotty fits on the pecking order kind of slides it. You even saw last night, like, you could have made the case going into that game, well, no Fred, no OG, you're starting Malachi Flynn. Scotty Barnes should be the number two option in terms of, are you running plays from? But to quote a friend of mine, James Herbert from CBS Sports, he texted me, he put up all-star stats on garbage man shot mix, which is, hey, like you said, that's a skill. And if you're looking for a place for Scotty Barnes to fit in, as the team gets healthier, Siakam's play turns around, Fred gets back, OG gets back, that's the kind of night you can still have even without the script being Scotty Barnes oriented.
It's interesting that it wasn't intentional, or as, at least as Nick Nurse says, because it felt intentional. Like, it felt like a game where it's like, okay, like, we know we're against an inferior opponent, we know we got guys who are, I don't know, let's say, not tired, banged up, we got a tough schedule ahead. Scotty, let's go out and ball tonight. That's what it felt like.
That Nets team, this is what I mean, though. It's like the game script did Matt, like LaMarcus Aldridge and Blake Griffin front court.
I did not
matters.
Play in that,
like,
game.
I'm sorry, but it's just like the Nets were completely checked out of that game. They could not have cared less. There was like a brief moment where I thought it was going to be some weirdly fun Siakam versus Blake Griffin night, because the two of them were jawing with one another. Siakam gets a block and he goes, get the bleep out of here, and Griffin takes offense, and then they're kind of jawing, and then Griffin hits a little step back at the end of a clock, and I go, ooh, no, the Nets were dead. They were dead on their feet. They could not have cared less about that game, and Barnes out-hustled them. So yes, is it a skill? But yeah. I also am like, I don't know. I don't think Scotty Barnes is going to get that kind of offensive rebounding night from a team. And from my standpoint, actually, like, some passes that he did make, all right. But I also had some notes about plays, like, he had a horrific turnover in the second half. And I think that is usually closer to where Scotty Barnes is as a playmaker, where if he's trying to do too much, then he kind of burns you right now. He's not there as an elevated playmaker or who you can run the ball through, and that's why Nurse didn't do it. Like, Malachi Flynn got the ball a lot. I thought he was the story of the game. We'll probably talk about him in a sec, but, like, I don't think that Malachi Flynn stepping off your bench and being given ball handling duties, or Gary Trent Jr., who can't pass, being given those duties ahead of Scotty Barnes was a coincidence in any way. Like, Barnes has to create for himself right now. That's who he is in his career. A guy who needs to hustle, who needs to bang the offensive boards, who needs to clean up, like, chippies or knock down wide open shots. And I don't really want to see the offense running through him right now, because, like, unless it's a blowout, I don't know if he's really capable.
But it was a blowout, so that's the perfect opportunity to try it and extend him a little more. And that's why he played, you know, in the fourth quarter and stuff. And look, you're right that he hasn't lifted the play of those around him with his playmaking. And that's why when you and I teed up the season last week, that's one of the big things, right? Scotty Barnes is having this great season, but it's not, like, metric-wise and component pairs-wise in terms of lineups, it's not leading to winning. So that's the next step. So I still thought last night was encouraging. JD, I know you kind of scoffed when I said this is what his game can look like when or the kind of night he can have. And obviously not every night. This is a career high. But the type of way he can fit in when everyone is back and there aren't as many touches for him. He's scored 20 points or more 12 times this year. He's had multiple offensive rebounds in 11 of those. He's had three plus in 8 of those. Like him hitting the glass like this and filling in at the margins is not that out of the realm of possibility. And I would suggest, like, obviously there's a chicken or an egg with, oh, did you shoot poorly and have fewer points, or did you shoot really well and that's why you had more opportunities? But his best nights have tended to be these lower field goal attempt nights, not lower, but like moderate field goal attempt nights where he does just kind of feel like he's fitting in. But yes, I do think that I led with Scotty Barnes because I thought it was a really, really fun. And other than the turnovers, because I thought Scotty was good defensively too. I thought he made some great reads there. I thought he had some fun in the second half. And those are the kind of things you want after you've been blown out 3 times in the last 4 nights. But yes, in terms of, hey, what's different about this game? What did we learn? Malachi Flynn coming out of the doghouse, and sure, he played a little bit the last couple games, but really dusted off, starts, plays 34 minutes, really, really good, 18 points, 5 assists, plus 42 in his 34 minutes. I know you've had some thoughts on Malachi Flynn's usage and why maybe it hasn't clicked for him, and you sure looked right after that one.
The reason why I scoffed, though, by the way, with Scotty Barnes is not that your points aren't correct, or that the game wasn't fun, or that he wasn't even the story of the game, because I think he still was, because you put up that stat line, you are, and plus, you know, you're the fourth overall pick in the draft, so that, I'm really not trying to poo-poo a really fun performance by a rookie. It's just that when we're talking about a guy whose game right now is built around being able to get deep post position or get offensive rebounds and score off of them, that I think about DVOA with football, where we say, well, what was your opponent?
And you don't want to over-extrapolate, too, right, too quickly.
I just think that Blake Griffin and LaMarcus Aldridge being the front court of the other team on a night where they went, we're not jumping with this young kid who's, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge has already established who he is in this league and what he accomplished in this league. Blake Griffin has done that as well. And so with Scotty Barnes coming in there with fresh legs, jumping all around them out of an all-star break where the two of those guys are like, we just want to ice up later. I did think that it's like, it's a DVOA game.
Andre Drummond gets hurt.
Right. It's a DVOA game. So I just looked at it and said, hey, I'm excited for you, but how replicable is getting 7 first-half offensive rebounds? I would say not very. In fact, I'm willing to say that that's going to be his career high for offensive rebounds in a half, that he's never going to do that again. 7 offensive rebounds in a half? That's an absurd statistic.
And if I'm remembering correctly, I mean, that helped him to a perfect shooting first half because there were a lot of, you know, just putbacks that he was – it came pretty easy, at least it seemed, to Scotty Barnes in that game. And who also had a perfect shooting half was Malachi Flynn, and he was taking obviously more mid-range jumpers than Scotty Barnes did. But that game to me felt like a night off, except for you, Scotty Barnes, except for you, Malachi Flynn, and maybe except for you, Precious Achiuwa. Like, it didn't seem like it was urgent.
It was also a night off
anyone.
For Ken Birch, who somehow didn't impact this game at all, despite it being a bunch of nobody still.
Exactly. I mean, maybe he fancies himself a veteran.
He's like, Kem Birch goes, I'll also take the night off, guys. I went, okay, Kem, that's fine. You can do that. Okay, so
I'm in
Flynn,
the Siakam class.
Flynn, Blake, I'm glad you brought this up. When we talked about Siakam earlier in the year, we talked about a guy who always needs to show that he's playing with joy. And even last night, he's not even on my concernometer radar because Siakam was playing with joy. Big smile, having fun. He's out there. He doesn't give a crap. Again, it was basically a night off, honest to God. That was as night off as it gets. They looked at it and went, oh, we have all the guys that are going to hustle in a game full of, as Blake calls them, jabronis. And so the hustle team is going to win there, right? You just showed up at the gym and it's a pickup game. The other team is going balls to the wall and you guys are on your third or fourth pickup game of the night and you go, yeah, I'm just not in it for the. I'm not going to pick you up at half court and like the way that you are. Malachi Flynn, I thought, looked like a guy playing with joy last night. And not to be over the top with the body language stuff, but you can just see it with a point guard like that. It's a position where you need to have the confidence of those around you, and you need to play with confidence. If you're playing tight as a guard who needs scoring as one of your primary weapons, then you make horrific mistakes. Malachi Flynn had a turnover, I think it was in the second half, where it's him and Scotty Barnes. It was horrific. It's like the two of them trying to set up and initiate the offense, and Malachi Flynn throws this terrible pass that gets picked off, and it goes the other way, and it's a dunk for the other team. And I'm thinking, if this is a meaningful game, or this is any other night, Nurse is stapling him to the pine for that play. And what happens? He doesn't get stapled. He knows that he gets to keep playing through his mistakes. That's what you have to do with young players. Not everyone is created equally with the idea of, hey, you go out there and the parameters are you're a depth player with depth responsibilities, and if you play outside of that, then you're going to sit. He's not Justin Champagne, right? It's not go out there and insert yourself by getting on the offensive glass. For Malachi Flynn to be effective, he needs to handle the ball, he needs to run the pick and roll, he needs to be able to get to the rim, he needs to be able to take jump shots, he needs to be able to make some aggressive plays. And so with an aggressive play player, you need to let him have a leash. And this is what I've always hated about the handling of Flynn. Let him play. Let's see who he is. Because the biggest issue I have is that Nurse is kind of Terrence Davis to him, like in the sense of, remember that game where Terrence Davis had a poor game, Nurse benches him, then he plays him against Charlotte in front of his family after the benching, and Terrence Davis goes off? Some guys respond to that, but other guys don't. And that's all I see with Malachi Flynn is, when he's been given opportunity, he looks like a guy who can run an offense as a secondary point guard in this league. And when he's being asked to be like the, you come in and close 2 minutes in a quarter and play 7 minutes a night, he looks totally lost and he's not able to find his game. So play Malachi Flynn, for God's sakes. I don't like saying a Fred injury is a good thing. It's never going to be, but this could actually be a really bright spot for the Raptors if this can mean some meaningful minutes for Flynn and he can get some run here.
There's a real element to me, and we talked about this early in the season when Delano Banton jumped Malachi Flynn in the rotation too, and it's, what did you draft the guy for, and how are you trying to use him, right? And there's a disconnect there where the book on Malachi Flynn, and the reason you were so high on him, was steady pair hands, very good pick and roll craft, very steady, solid defender within, you know, the concept of how you want to defend a pick and roll if you're defending it fairly conservatively. And then he gets rolled out in this hyper-aggressive scheme where they don't want to slow it down in the half court. They don't want to use pick and roll with their bench players very much. And he's had a tough adjustment. Last year as a rookie, it was, hey, we need more defensive force from you. We don't want to drop under screens. We don't want to play those conservatively. We need you up in the ball and up in the body and living in the jersey. And then this year at the start of the season, it was, we need that offensively. We need you pushing the pace. We don't want you to walk it up and survey. Like, you're not a bench Chris Paul. And that's, you know, certainly if you're a fringe rotation player, that's on you to learn that a little bit and change your game. But also, what did you draft this guy thinking he was, right? And so, JD, to your point about letting him play and letting him play through it, this is only the second time all season he's played double-digit minutes in three straight games. And last year, when has Malachi Flynn looked his absolute best? Yes, it was the garbage
preseason.
Well, I was going to say, at the end of last year, where, like, yes, it's a garbage part of a garbage season, but he was playing 20 minutes plus every day. The last 24 games of last year, he averaged 13, 4, and 5. And he didn't shoot well on twos, but he shot the three well. He shot the free throws well. Really, like, 3-to-1 assist to turnover ratio as a rookie over, like, a quarter of a season stretch. So, obviously, you don't want to advocate, hey, you got to play this guy 25 minutes a night, and no matter what mistakes he makes, he has unlimited leash. That's not what either of us are saying. But how do you expect a guy who's a feel-based guy and a tempo-based guy and to really elevate those things and execute within that when he's looking over his shoulder, right?
Yes.
And
that's
so
it. That's Blake.
I thought originally the Goran Dragic thing, like shooting him to the moon early in the season, was – I thought that was about Flynn and being like, hey, look, man, you're going to get the opportunity here and you're going to get some run. And then Delano Banton kind of beat him out. And then he had that brief blip in November and that's it. So I don't know. I want to see more of this. Certainly he's not going to play 34 minutes in a game when Fred's back, but I don't see any, he played 19 minutes in that Atlanta game. And some of that was garbage time. Sure. I don't see any reason why the way this roster is constructed, if he's playing even semi-capably, he can't be in that 16 to 18 minute range.
There are minutes in pretty much every game that are maybe not quite as bad from an opposition standpoint as what the Brooklyn Nets showed at times in that game. But there are minutes in any game where Malachi Flynn should be an impact player. And I think maybe some of the frustration on the part of the Raptors coaching staff is that what we saw in extended minutes from Malachi Flynn isn't present in those limited minutes at the end of, you know, quarters or in garbage time or what have you. I think maybe, you know, you say that he has to play to show his complete portfolio. Why is it that he can't seem to do that in those, you know, 2-3 minute stretches to prove that he can get more run under Nick Nurse?
Because I think Blake nailed it where he said he's a flow player. Some guys need to be able to figure out like where they're fitting in the flow of a game. And sometimes with Malachi, they've inserted him. This is the gift and the curse of being with the Raptors is, okay, can you play off the ball? You got to be able to play off the ball as a guard. I don't see him as someone who does that particularly well so far. And again, granted, we haven't seen exactly a lot of minutes of it, so it's hard to really make this a firm take for me because he could go out there to, what, they play tonight actually, right? He could go out there tonight and they could end up playing him off the ball and he could knock down a ton of shots and I would go, huh, I didn't know that he was capable of that. He doesn't seem to be capable of that right now. And the Raptors do like multiple ball handlers, multiple guys who initiate the offense, and guys who are hyper-intelligent. I'm not sure that that's a part of his game. What I am sure of, when you put the ball in his hands and you say, you can run with this for quite some time and find your place in this game, whether it's attacking, whether it's that mid-range game, whether it's that three-point shot that he has that he can shoot when the screener goes under, he can find a way to be an effective offensive player. I don't know what degree it is, but I want to find it out. I think it's a far more fascinating question than, hey, can Delano Banton do it right now? Because it's like, no, not really. He doesn't have that same offensive profile. But yes,
and Delano
flow player,
wasn't supposed,
Blake, you hit it.
Delano wasn't supposed to do it yet. He was a second-round pick who, you know, my sales job on Delano Banton was, hey, I really like what this guy could be after maybe a year or two with the 905. Yeah. Not day one as a rotation guy. And, you know, in terms of finding out what Malachi Flynn is, yes, he's almost 24 years old. He was a first-round pick. He was a guy who came out in the book on him was he was supposed to have a shorter developmental curve because he was a senior and he had led one of the best college, like he had been one of the best college point guards.
But that's true because look at where his game's at right now despite not having played in the NBA for 2 years.
Yes. And so the other factor here is, and this isn't a huge deal, but sometime this summer, you're going to have to make a decision on Malachi's under contract next year, and then you have a team option on him for the season after that you have to pick up by sometime this summer. And not only for the option part, but you got to figure out, is this guy your backup point guard next year? Or is that an area you really need to target with your mid-level exception or in trade? Because I think we all know that they're going to try to, or they better try to get at least one kind of change of pace, more traditional center in there. But they really need some backup guard play. And if over these last 20 games, Malachi Flynn can give you that, then I think that that makes your offseason a little easier, where you're looking for, you know, someone who could plug in as the number three or something like that, rather than, hey, we got to get Fred a backup. We got to get Fred a backup. The other thing, too, is Malachi quietly has, like, throughout the season, and again, lots of noise here with how many guys have been in and out. He's had a really nice on-off impact fairly consistently. He's 61st percentile in the league in terms of on-off impact, which
I don't
for a guy
know what
playing
this is supposed to mean to me, though, when he mostly plays garbage time.
Right, but this filters out garbage time.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Yeah, this is from cleaning the glass. So they cut out the garbage time. If I wanted to include garbage time, I would tell you that over the last 9 games, he's plus 77 and the Raptors
I was just
and the Raptors
say,
are
like,
minus 66
the,
when he's not on the court.
This is the weirdest stat for you to ever bring up is this guy is like in garbage time, Malachi
cleaning
comes
the glass
in
filters that out.
Okay, cool.
There's still a ton of noise there. Like we're talking about 300 non-garbage time minutes.
Right.
But anyway, it's just to kind of affirm that he's helping the team when he's on the court more often than not. Even when the shot's not dropping.
I think Justin's question is the one that most fans have, which is like, why can't this guy find a way to impact it? Why can't he figure out? Because clearly the skill set is a desirable one, right? When you see him getting to the rim, when you see him hitting a little step back and you go, wow, his footwork, like he is an advanced player from a footwork standpoint offensively already. He had some buckets in that game where you go, oh, that was pretty. That you've shot that shot a billion times.
He also has like the best shooting mechanics in league history for a guy who only hits 30% of his shots.
Yeah, it's his game is very aesthetically pleasing. I just look at him and say, what I noticed with Flynn and what I've noticed from the very beginning is that in games where he's asked to come in off the bench and provide this kind of, I'm the maybe third option on the floor, fourth option on the floor, and if I miss a jump shot and it's semi-contested and I look off one of the other players, I'm going to get set on the bench. He has not responded well to that. He's a guy who, if you look at his college career, when he took off, it was, hey, you're our everything man. You're doing everything on the floor. Everything's running through you constantly. It's funny because he's like, in a weird way, he's like the anti-Siakam, where Siakam came out of school and it was, hey, this guy's learning everything right now. He's a puppy. He's got nothing built in. Oh, when he struggles, it's because he doesn't have anything to lean on. For Malachi Flynn, it's the opposite, where he goes, I don't know how to do these other jobs because I've never been asked to do them before. My team was just like, Malachi, score all of our points, run all of our offense, play all of our minutes. He never had the reps of trying to fill in as just a guy on the team. And so maybe that's part of his developmental curve, is he gets there eventually, but I think he needs to have a solid footing in, at least I have a role on this team, and at least, you know, my role isn't I'm the guy who has the dad who tweets.
Yeah, it's a matter of expectation, right? Like, when Malachi comes in, it's be Fred. I mean, give us the same thing that Fred did in terms of running the team. Whereas when Delano Banton comes in, it's like, give us this pop of offense. Like, change the game because
yeah,
you're
be
in it, because you're doing something
be a long
completely
kid
different.
Who can make a steal.
Exactly. It's like a completely different situation. And I guess Nurse, at least to this point or early on, sort of prioritized, hey, let's change things up, let's throw the curveball, rather than be the lesser Fred or the lesser complete team dynamic, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. It's bang on. Dude, look at what we expect from Delano Banton. If he gets a defensive rebound, we go, look how tall he is. He's out there getting rebounds. Wow, that's really fun. Oh, he grabbed a rebound. He dribbled it off the floor. That's nice. And then he doesn't have to do anything else. He gets to the basket one or two times a game, and you freak out about it. With Malachi Flynn, it's, well, he better hit that step back over this guy. And if he misses it, well, then, boy, he's a bust. It's just this completely different parameters for expectations. That makes a ton of sense.
All right, it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. And I mentioned that one of the Raptors' targets this offseason will very likely be a center. A favorite target of Raptors fans heading into this trade deadline, no longer viable. Jakob Poeltl, rest in peace. Yeah. John Morant absolutely ended him last night. Something to chew on here, though, is not the eulogy for Jakob Poeltl. John Morant set a Grizzlies franchise record last night with 52 points. He has 98 points over his last two games. And JD, I know that you have some jaw stuff because he wanted money to go in the dunk contest and he had his worst game of the season when you were there in person. However, the thing I come back to sometimes, and the reason that that jaws the something to chew on here today, is because you talked earlier in the show about how the haters fuel you, right? You get those guys who reach out and it lets you know they're watching and you're doing a good job because they're hating, but they're hooked. And this is a kid who once said that his dad was his first hater, and that has fueled him.
That. I know.
So I just got to say, there's something that you want here. JD, is your gripe with Jaw the dunk contest thing? Is it the live performance thing? Or is it that you see some real similarities between yourself and Jaw here, and that's a little bit of dissonance for you to navigate? He's out here getting 98 points over two games. You're putting up 100-point games on the show. I think it's there's an arm's length you keep Jaw at because you see similarities there, not because of the dunk contest or the bad game in Washington.
First of all, the team that I have watched the second most of this year to the Raptors is 1,000% the Grizzlies, and
they're
it's
the most
not
fun team in basketball. It's not close.
It's not particularly close. I love Ja Morant. Like, I'm obsessed with Ja Morant, and I'm so excited for his career. Blake, you know me. You know the kind of the guards that I gravitate towards. Well, the players I gravitate towards are almost always guards. Like, but they are the guards who play different than everybody else, right? Chris Paul is one of my favorite players of all time, and I got to share something on my Instagram story the other day. Actually, yesterday. It should still be up there. Of young Chris Paul, who was unbelievably explosive. And I went, look at this little bowling ball who just explodes out of nowhere. Ja Morant is tall. He's like this blend of Derrick Rose and Chris Paul. And I just adore him. I adore his game. I adore his attitude. There's so much about the guy that I just love, 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 love. The stuff about, you know, the dunk contest is annoying to me because I really just wish that I just want someone to come around who thinks it's cool to care. And that's all I want, is someone who thinks it's cool to care. Because the NBA has been too cool for a long time now, where nobody cares, nobody cares, nobody cares. NHL suffers from the same problem. NHL All-Star Weekend, everybody's too cool. Oh, I'm too cool for this interview. I'm too cool to do this. It's like, okay, we get it, man. We understand. But Ja, to me, can be just this, like, oh, I can't even get into this. I'll do 3 hours on why I love Ja Morant. But it's like, this guy, the way he plays basketball, the intensity he brings in regular season games, the athleticism, the brilliance, the playmaking, just all of it, to me, he could absolutely be the face of this league. Like, we could be talking about him a year from now. I'm excited for the prospect of the Lakers winning their play-in game, playing Memphis, and us really having this moment where Ja goes in and ends LeBron James, and we go, man, what would we be doing if this guy was actually on the Knicks? Had they ended up with that 2 pick instead of the 3-1 and getting RJ?
How many injuries is Anthony Davis going to fake after Ja dunks on him in game one of that series? Like,
Jakob Poeltl's a good guy, though, too. Poor guy. Yeah. Like, he deserved that. This poor Jak. Yeah. Like,
well, the best part was Ja went up for another dunk after, and Jak made the business decision of, nope, not this time. Look, this is a guy, Allen Iverson's posting at 2 in the morning last night, Ja Morant's jersey hanging on his Hall of Fame bust. Like, this is how cool he, and Allen Iverson's the best because he's the one ex-player who, like, all he wants to talk about is how much he loves the game and how much he loves the current crop of guys instead of doing the opposite. But this is how engaging and fun Ja Morant is, and the Grizzlies, where Allen Iverson is up at 2 a.m. posting about how cool and fun Ja Morant is.
This is why I'll always resent Russell Westbrook, because Russell Westbrook could have been this if he just realized that there were some times in a game where he needed to pass. Ja has a better jump shot, but this is the thing that always breaks me about Russ, is that Russ in his prime was one of the most jaw-dropping players I have ever seen. Like, you want to talk about a guy who profiles perfectly to just be a champion? It was him. He could have taken over this league. He could have been one of the league's greatest players ever. He could have actually deserved to be on the top 75 list. Like, that's how good he is that he is a basketball moron, and yet he made the top 75. Like, it's crazy. He leapfrogged Pau Gasol, for God's sakes. They left Pau Gasol off so that they could put Russell Westbrook and his zero meaningful minutes in basketball ever into the top 75 list because of his athleticism. And when I watch Ja, I go, this is what Russell Westbrook could have been had he just had an ounce of self-awareness and an ounce of, oh, you know what, maybe we can win if I pass, or maybe we can win if it isn't me taking a contested three off a pull-up late in a game when Kevin Durant is right beside me wide open.
Is it too late for MVP for Ja this season? Like, can he bust down that door in the last 30 games with Embiid and Jokic being what seems like the top two right now?
Embiid's going to get it. If Embiid keeps on this trajectory, especially like the way he and Harden have started off, has been insane. And if they're going to carry the narrative, it's going to be Embiid. I think Jokic could be just as deserving, but Embiid, just narratively, if he can just stay healthy, I think basketball writers are going to be so thrilled that that happened and we got the complete Embiid season that they're going to award him for that, especially considering there is an element of, hey, is he really ever going to be healthy for a full regular season? Like, are we ever going to get a beast mode MVP regular season from Embiid again? I think he's kind of all, like, way down the track in the narrative race. It would take an injury to open it up.
Yeah, and Ja missed 14 games and the Grizzlies went 12-2, which that's not fair to Ja necessarily, because
it is damning.
Adds to the narrative.
For an MVP case anyway. Wouldn't be surprised if he gets some back ballot votes. So Ja Morant, JD, Ja Morant's father, his first hater, JD Bunkus, no longer his latest hater.
No, let's still hate him as he's not for not doing the dunk contest. Like, do the dunk contest, Ja. You're the greatest dunker in the league right now. Do the dunk contest.
When we come back, we're going to take some of your texts, 590-590, or hit us in the DMs or whatever. Talk about whatever. Leafs, Raptors, baseball. Tell us who your first hater was. Anything like that. We're also going to give away tickets to Motley Crue and Def Leppard for this summer. All that's next on the Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590, The Fan.
Yum, yum, yum.
Everything Raptors before and after the games. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Morning Show. Of course, at 590 The Fan, Blake Murphy, J.D. Bunkus, Justin Cuthbert. Before we fire up your texts, we got to give you tickets to a concert this summer. Rock legends Motley Crue and Def Leppard are coming to Toronto, and we want to send you. We're giving away tickets all week long to their August 8th show at Rogers Centre. If you want to win a pair of tickets, be caller number 5 right now at 416-870-0590 or 1-888-666-0590 or just dial *590. If you missed today, tune in for your chance to win tomorrow and every day this week. So that's Motley Crue and Def Leppard. Another legend who we're without today is Ailish. JD, you got to do your best Ailish impression here, firing up the text line. I tried to eat chips last night to get in the right mind frame before realizing I don't have the login for the text for mental health purposes. They keep me out of there. What do you got for us in the text line?
So first of all, you just answer the very first one of the questions, which is, hi, did I miss the Motley Crue contest? No, you just got it right now. So hopefully that person is on the line and trying to get it. Again, 590, 590. You can also hit me up in the DMs. Shoot me those Wake and Rake parlay wins. I want to see them. It's another winner, 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 especially boosted if you played it on Cool Bet. I have a bunch of different texts. I'm going to start with one that is directed right at me, but I am going to kick it around to the two of you guys, which is, how excited is JD for the Netflix Drive to Survive Season 4 starting March 11th. I am pumped. Mike from Stratford. So, Mike, I asked these two guys before the show about whether or not they're going to watch whatever. Justin revealed to me that he has yet to watch the Drive to Survive series, which makes me believe that, I don't know, you obviously have something incredible in your home. That you like, do you have VR or something like that? That you didn't watch Netflix's number one pandemic series, whatever. Maybe you had your own. What did you have? Do you have a rink in your house? Like, what do you have that kept you, that you're so high and mighty that you didn't have to join us in Drive to Survive?
Okay, here are the circumstances. I tried to watch it on a plane. So, you know, when you're getting ready to travel, you download a bunch on Netflix. So I downloaded the entire first season.
You went to Cabo during the pandemic. You were like those politicians who were like, stay home, stay home. And then,
pre-pandemic. Yeah. Pre-pandemic. So I enjoyed it. Got me through that flight. But then I feel like when I tried to pick it up again, it was like, I'm back on the flight. I'm uncomfortable. This isn't ideal. And I let it slip through the pandemic so far that I feel like I'm so many seasons removed now that I'm a lost cause here. So I blame the plane.
So here's what I would like to tell you. There's no amount of seasons that you could fall behind where going back and watching it isn't thrilling and fascinating. In fact, I would argue that it's even better having more of this show. That there's no let up, there's no fatigue factor. It's just good. It's just unbelievably good. Yeah,
I was just going to say, the main dilemma, and I should have touched on this, I feel like I need to rewatch what I watched because I was on a plane and not paying the attention that I felt like it needed. Like, I was kind of in and out, maybe a little nap here, trying to order a Coke as the cart goes by. Like, I didn't give it what it deserved. And I'm like, do I want to rewatch these 8 hours? I don't know if I'm ready for that. So that's, I think, my main dilemma is that it requires the rewatch. Am I willing to put the rewatch in?
Can I just say one thing to that? That was what you just described, minus the airplane, but falling asleep at night and kind of rewatching and having to watch and not being able to get into a show. That was me with The Wire in university. People kept telling me about
The
Wire, and I kept falling asleep, and I couldn't get into it. And guess what? Now it's my favorite show. You know, it's my favorite show of all time because I actually stuck with it and I powered through and I went to it. This is I'm a TV snob. I love sports content. I give this show is the full stamp JD approval, one of the greatest shows of all time, the F1 series. That's how staunch I feel in this position. It is must-see TV. Everybody goes, oh, you haven't seen Captain America Civil War? You gotta see it. No, you don't. You don't have to see any Captain America movie. If you've seen any Marvel movie, you wasted 3 hours of your life that you could have been watching the Netflix series. It's just so good. if you care about sports, if you care about drama, if you care about interesting personalities, it's just, it's incredible. And I don't care about cars. I could, like, cars are, when I meet car guys and they go, this is what I think about car, I go, yeah, it's cool. Carburetors, right? It's killer. Steering wheels. I don't care. I don't care about cars. I love this Netflix series. Season four, I'm building an entire day of just sitting around and vegging out and crushing the entire thing. I cannot wait. I'm going to take detailed notes. I'm going to have a billion takes off of it. But this season of F1 was incredible. And this is the first time where I actually tracked the full season of F1 and feel like a somewhat fan, even though I'll still be a rube and a noob and whatever the hardcores want to say. But this is the first time where I get to kind of go back and relive the moments of the season through the perspective of the show. We get to see Toto and Christian just head to head. We get to see the way that Lewis and Max, one of the greatest rivalries in sports right now, if not the greatest rivalry in sports right now, a little bit behind the scenes. I have never been so... I'm compared to the Amazon Leafs Prime series, this is like... I don't even know how to compare the two. It's like, yeah, The Wire versus Big Bang Theory. Like, it's the complete opposite.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You don't even need to compare them. It's just like the framing of... Well, the Amazon Prime series was something we had to watch because we had to talk about it on the show. And the Drive to Survive is something you're going to, quote, have to work onto the show because you want to watch it so bad. Not that, obviously, this is a sports show. We could find windows for it. So for me, I haven't watched the previous seasons. I've got a week when it comes out March 11th between when it drops and when the 2022 F1 season starts. I think that's enough time. I don't know that I'm going to go back and watch the first three seasons. Like, I probably will eventually, but I don't really need to. I want to watch season four because it's the first season where, yeah, I was paying a modicum of attention and by the end was watching those races and stuff. So I'm looking forward to it too, March 11th.
I think back and watch last season and then this one.
Season three,
would be my play. You watch season three and then you watch this one. The only thing that's so fascinating about having seen all the series now, anyways, from my vantage point, is like the very first season opens with Max and just how this guy is going to basically be the face of F1. And you go, it's him versus Daniel Ricciardo essentially as the faces of Red Bull. And Ricciardo wins at Monaco. And there's a part of you that goes, wow, Daniel Ricciardo is really sort of hard done by in the way that they're pushing this kid. How good is this guy going to be? Blah, 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 blah. And so the series in its entirety just does such a great job of documenting Max Verstappen's career that it does feel very full picture as all the seasons combined. Like, that's the way I'd be looking at it if I was trying to go back and watch it. There's just no way you're going to be disappointed. But yes, if I was doing a catch-up, I'd watch last season, catch myself up on what the narratives were, and then I'd watch this one because we were paying close attention. And I think that, man, imagine there was documentation of the behind the scenes of the Golden State Warriors and Cleveland Cavaliers rivalry, right? Like the finals between those two teams, and you got to actually see the coaches in the film room and the way that they interacted with each other on the court, how Draymond Green responded to his suspension, right? Like, imagine you got to see 2016. That's the first rivalry I could think of, or the most recent one in my life. You would kill to watch that. And this Netflix series, we're not as familiar with the sport in North America is just like an entirety. I know there are some people who are, but that's really what you get. You're getting a look into this Red Bull Mercedes rivalry, which right now is among the greatest in sports, and the way that they will speak about one another and act around this, it's so unbelievably compelling.
What's your level of excitement for the PGA's version of this?
Zero.
You know, the narratives aren't quite there. But what's happening with Phil Mickelson right now? If these guys are going off on him, and I feel like they're trying and maybe trying too hard in some ways. I mean, we'll see what the final product is. But with all this Phil stuff going on right now, I mean, that piques my interest. That should be interesting to see how these guys react to what is happening right now. I'm like you. I didn't think, like, is it going to be that interesting? Are they going to have things? But with Bryson, Phil, Saudi, all these different things, it actually might be decent.
Okay, so I'm going to watch it. So I shouldn't say zero, because zero implies that I'm not going to watch it. And the first day that series comes out, I'm going to devour it. So it's clear, it's clearly not a zero. I just think that the difference here and why I love this Netflix series is that the media training, whatever, that these guys in F1 get compared to what we have here in North America is night and day difference. Everyone here is so cognizant of their brand and what they say and the way that it can get spun into something. And golf is an emotional game, obviously, but you're not interrupting someone for a quick quote for the Netflix series, right? Some of these dudes get out of race cars. They get out of a race car where their adrenaline's going to be going like a billion miles per hour. They've just had a crash, or someone almost ran them off the road. They thought about, like, they've almost lost their lives. And then all of a sudden they're completely mic'd up and dealing with the stresses and anxieties of driving a race car, someone yelling in their ear, the fact that they're driving like a piece of equipment that's worth millions of dollars. It's just like there's some things that are built into the F1 series that you can't really replicate with other sports. And when I think about like the difference in terms of, I don't know, urgency and whatever with golf and race car driving, it couldn't be more stark. The other part of it is that for the most part, everybody in golf is best friends with each other except for Bryson. So I'd be curious to see like how the Bryson thing plays out. But don't you already feel like you have a grasp of Bryson, that he's kind of a crybaby who has been insulated from any type of reality? And he's pretty oblivious and doesn't seem to care what his peers think about him, but really deeply cares if he can drive the ball the furthest. Like, I'm just not sure there's layers to Bryson DeChambeau that we're going to learn about in a Netflix series that I go, wow, Bryson's really misunderstood. Like, I think
and
he's
properly understood. They might have missed the boat on his relevance, too. Like, I feel like last year was the Bryson year. And
yeah, it's like
I wouldn't be surprised if he was wholly uninteresting. I don't even think he's involved, is he? Did Bryson turn them down? I think that was one of the controversies. I mean, you can hear guys talking smack about Bryson, but I feel like, you know, it's definitely shifted to Phil and what's going on with this potential rival league that's not going to happen. But that has dominated the discourse around the golf world around the last 2 months.
Yeah, that's the other part of this, is that I go, that's not going to happen. And so sometimes I think the golf world, just like all sports worlds, right, we get so immersed in these things because they're so big to us that we go, this is massive, this could be a thing. And then the rest of the world looks at it and goes, you really think that there's going to be a rival golf league that steals golfers? Like, no, it's not going to happen. So, yeah, it's a nice little idea in theory, but I don't know. I want to see it. I want to see the series. It's just it's tough to sell me on the PGA, the personalities in the PGA, the sport itself. I don't know.
I do think the precedent is important, though. Like, the fact that they have this successful F1 series, they know that the expectation is that. I feel like they could find some ways to actually produce some quality storytelling.
I hope they do.
But I think you want to see more of, like, what I remember from Drive to Survive, like, a lot of stories about the drivers early on, right? Like going behind the scenes and getting them in their homes and talking about other things other than racing. That's what it felt like to me early. I'd like to see that side of PGA Tour professionals rather than coming off the course, tipping their cap to whoever they played with after both shooting, you know, 6-under 66s. Like, that's not as interesting as what potentially could be happening in their real lives.
Yeah. I just am more interested in the type of person who wants to drive a race car than the type of person who wants to swing a golf club, which is everybody. You know, like, it's but either way, I think it's going to be good for golf. And it also has the low expectation bar for me, right? Where it's, hey, I'm going into this thing not expecting very much, so it's probably going to exceed my expectations.